I have had some absolutely amazing experiences these past few months. Among them, I rode along with a police officer from the 1st Division on his midnight to 8 a.m. shift. I had a chance to shadow an emergency room physician as he tracked 12 patients at Saints Mary and Elizabeth Hospital. I took a tour of the Louisville Metro Jail and spoke with guards and inmates. Everything I experienced confirmed my belief that empathy is to the moral life as blood is to the body. It carries moral nutrients like compassion and responsibility from person to person and from community to community. And then I read an essay in the Boston Review that challenged me to think that I was entirely wrong about empathy. It turns out that empathy has been a hot topic of debate among scientists. A number of prominent neuroscientists and psychologists have made some pretty counterintuitive claims about empathy as a moral guide. These scientists contend that certain features of empathy can be toxic to our psychological and our moral health. Yale psychologist Paul Bloom makes a bold claim in a recent work on empathy. If you want to be good and do good, empathy is a poor guide. Empathy is used in so many ways that synonyms abound where definitions fail. But Bloom thinks the most common meaning of empathy corresponds to sympathy. He writes, "To empathize with someone is to put yourself in her shoes, to feel her pain. Empathy is a process of experiencing the world as others do, or at least as you think they do. And the latest laboratory studies tell us that feeling the pain of others makes empathy unreliable as a moral guide." In studying empathy, psychologists distinguish between its emotional and its cognitive elements. Cognitive empathy involves a consideration of what other people think, their motivations, their beliefs, their plans. But it is the emotional side of empathy that is at the heart of the moral debate. The crux of the matter is that empathy is a poor guide for moral behavior because it is biased and narrow. Psychologists say that two features of empathy should trouble us. First, we're more prone to feel empathy for attractive people, for people who look like us, and people who share our ethnic or national background. And second, we're more prone to feel empathy for the one than for the many. Empathy is insensitive to numerical differences and statistical data. These features of empathy make it a poor moral guide and an absolutely terrible guide for social policy. If you're experiencing deja vu, it is likely because great thinkers have debated whether our rational minds need to control our emotional or subconscious minds since the time of Plato. The latest laboratory studies support those who have argued for reason over emotion. This part of the debate is old. Scientists have attached some very helpful psychological findings to a philosophy that divides reason from emotion. And then they fault emotion for our bias and for causing us to miss the moral mark. But reason hides bias as cleverly as emotion. Unconscious bias turns reason into rationalization. Fortunately, the laboratory studies do more than just revive an old philosophical debate. They also present some empirical evidence for claims against empathy that we would be wise to consider. Laboratory studies find that empathy imposes a personal cost. Take the work of psychologists Vicki Helgeson and Heidi Fritz. They want to know why women are twice as likely as men to experience depression. Their research suggests that emotional empathy, feeling another's pain, results in psychological distress. Empathetic distress is the name for this psychological condition caused by a high degree of empathy. It is helpful to understand that empathy comes at a cost and that women are more likely than men to pay that cost. Empathy is equally worrisome at the level of social policy. The case against empathy at this level is easily illustrated. As a nation, we can donate great sums of money to the family of a child stuck in a well and ignore the children stuck in ghettos. As a nation, we feel deep empathy when some children die violently in schools, but not when other children die violently in the streets. It is helpful to know that our social policies reflect the narrowness of our regard for others. We are predisposed to help people who look like us, or who think like us, or who share our language, or who share our beliefs. Bloom thinks that our humanitarian aims will be better served once we set empathy aside. Now, in fairness, Bloom understands that some degree of empathy is, to use his expression, bred in the bone. And he knows that emotional empathy can occur automatically and involuntarily. We cannot just turn it off, but we can learn to override our empathetic responses. The solution is non-empathetic compassion, which is a more distanced love and kindness and concern for others. Kindness and altruism are good substitutes for empathy that do not put us at risk for empathetic distress. If we just set empathy aside, we will appreciate that 100 deaths are worse than one. If we set empathy aside, we will value lives in faraway countries as much as the lives of our friends and neighbors. If we set empathy aside, we will be better able to rethink the criminal justice system. When we live counter-empathetic lives, we will help others with greater efficiency and we'll be happier in the process. Consider the work of Tanya Singer, a psychologist and neuroscientist. Singer conducted experiments in which people were given either empathy training with its focus on the capacity to experience the suffering of others, or compassion training with its focus on responding to suffering with feelings of warmth and care. She found that compassion training was more effective, leading to increases in positive emotions and altruism. It is helpful to know that experiencing the suffering of others can be so psychologically overpowering that we are unable to act. We can become so utterly lost in suffering of the crowd that we feel completely inadequate to act in ways that relieve the suffering. The promise of non-empathetic compassion is catching on. There's an emerging movement among young, affluent professionals that is organized around the concept of earning to give. A more formal name is effective altruism. Effective altruists believe that being a good person is not about emotion. Instead, it is about distanced compassion, self-control, and justice. Effective altruism is also about numbers. On average, effective altruists donate 10 to 50% of their income to charities that have been proven to be highly effective. In May of 2013, the Washington Post profiled some of these altruists in a story entitled, "Join Wall Street, Save the World." Jason Trigg was one of the altruists profiled. Trigg graduated from MIT with a degree in computer science, but instead of going into academia, he went into finance on Wall Street so that he could make a lot of money. Trigg earns well over $100,000 per year, and he donates half to charities that have been carefully selected based on the criteria of biggest bang for the buck. For example, you might donate $40,000 to provide and train a guide dog for one blind American, or for the same amount of money, you might cure between 400 and 2,000 people in developing countries of blindness from glaucoma. To sum up, feeling deeply the pain of others is destructive of the individual in the long run, and it is not necessary to charitable giving. Love, kindness, and concern for others at a distance is a psychological plus and a moral plus. It will make you physically healthier, psychologically happier, and morally better. The choice is clear. If you want to be good and do good, then you might need a new moral guide. I turn this morning to two stories that help us to better understand the nature of compassion in biblical thought and what role it plays in the moral life. One thing is clear from the outset. The compassion that we find in Hosea and in Mark is not the non-empathetic, distanced compassion that some psychologists recommend. On the contrary, the Bible speaks of God's loving kindness, wrath, frustration, pain, and rejoicing. Divine pathos is the suggestion that God is not only capable of emotion, but is more emotionally sensitive than humans. It is one of the most original and important concepts of Abraham Heschel. Heschel was a Jewish-American rabbi, scholar, philosopher, who was very active in the civil rights movement. Heschel argued that God is moved and affected by what happens in the world and reacts accordingly. Far from reacting arbitrarily or capriciously, God's emotional reaction has a consistent moral purpose: to evoke love and to establish a community in which people love their neighbors as themselves. Along with divine pathos, Heschel developed a second and corollary concept. Prophetic sympathy means sharing in God's emotions. Heschel turned to the prophets of Israel and found that the prophets were guided not by what they feel, but by what God feels. This empathic sharing is not some mystical ecstasy in which the soul of the prophet is just swallowed up by the infinite. Rather, it is more like emotional solidarity with God. Nor is this emotional sharing an escape from reality. The Bible is concerned with actions that participate in God's purposes. The prophet Hosea is in emotional solidarity with God. Heschel tells us that Hosea's central lament is that Israel does not know God. Israel lacks knowledge of God. But knowledge is not just cognitive, not just intellectual. The knowledge of God is both intellectual and emotional. It encompasses an inner appropriation, deep feeling, and a reception into the heart. Hosea paints a beautiful and haunting portrait of divine pathos. The text begins with tenderness and expressions of God's love and care for Israel, but Israel has a wayward spirit and wearies herself turning away from God. Despite God's goodness, leading Israel in close and intimate fellowship and gentle treatment, Israel refused to return to God. Then the tone changes abruptly. In the place of tenderness and care, we find righteous indignation and deep frustration. Punishment is threatened because of Israel's failure to remain faithful to God. The tone changes again, and we feel God's anguish and emotional turmoil. God's holiness demands that God punish Israel. They will reap what they have sown, but God cannot cease to love. How can I give you up? My compassion grows warm and tender. No, God will not destroy Israel. Instead, God will roar like a lion and gather the children home. They will fly to God's voice like little birds. Hosea's illumination of divine pathos informs how we understand the feeding story in Mark. Our text presents a miracle. Mark emphasizes the compassion that Jesus has for the crowd. Jesus sees that they are hungry. More than this, Jesus sees that they might faint from hunger if he sends them away without bread. The disciples respond to this compassion with a practical question. Where do we find enough bread in the wilderness to feed such a large crowd? Jesus asks, how many loaves do you have? 7 was the reply. I don't know what the number 7 symbolizes, but it's clear that the question was not really about the quantity of loaves. Jesus is confident that the divine bounty will satisfy the people. The question, how many loaves do you have, invites the disciples to act, to do good, to feed the people with what they have at hand, even though they worry that they don't have enough. Jesus does not set empathy aside in favor of a distanced compassion. His compassion is rooted in the pathos of God. Jesus feels deeply what the people feel, and he anticipates what will happen to them if they are not fed. The disciples are challenged to cooperate with Jesus, to act in solidarity with God's purposes. Choice before us is not empathy or action. Empathy in biblical thought is inextricably tied to actions that build the beloved community, a community of mutual friendship. We visit the sick, comfort mourners, feed the hungry, care for widows and orphans, not because these activities provide the biggest bang for the buck, but because we're building a community in which everyone loves her neighbor as herself. This is the moral task of empathy in biblical thought, to build a community of mutual friendship and interdependent relationship. The new insights about empathy help us to appreciate the psychological burden of this moral task. Empathy predisposes us to see the person in need, but God calls us to see the crowd as well. Empathy predisposes us to help the people with whom we connect, but God calls us to love with actions that overcome the enmity and strife between people. Empathy predisposes us to become so enmeshed with others in their suffering that we become overwhelmed and unable to act. But God calls us to moral clarity. Take stock of your loaves and feed the people. Like the disciples in the wilderness, God's compassion creates an ethical obligation for us. We are called to do a good deed, to feed the crowd. But the deed is not good merely because we do it with feeling. It is good because it participates in God's justice and mercy and loving kindness. When we see the enormity of the crowd, see the need that we have to meet, and doubt in the deepest fathoms of our soul whether we can do anything, remember that God only asks us to give what we have. If you don't have enough love, God only asks for the love that you have. If you don't have enough hope, God only asks for the hope that you have. If you don't have enough faith, God only asks for the faith that you have. If you don't have enough strength, God only asks for the strength that you have. If you haven't yet found your voice, God only asks for the voice that you have. If you've lost your courage, God only asks for the courage you have. This much I know. When we gather together in community and take stock of our loaves, God will feed God's children, and they will be satisfied.